All right, good morning. Welcome to the second week of review of classical physics. I hope you had a nice weekend. Did you go to Niagara Falls or?
Yes.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. Did you go to the wineries as well? No.
Too expensive for us.
Okay, next time.
maybe P&G is
you did. So you went all the way to the river. Perfect, perfect, excellent. All right, so let me just briefly recapitulate. I would say the strongest point of Hamiltonian mechanics. And it is a possibility to exploit the freedom, you know, encoded in these canonical transformations. So I can go from new, from old coordinates, small q and small p, in which the Hamilton's equations look like dh over small p equals to small q dot, and dh over d small q equals to minus small p dot, to new kind of coordinates, which are now right as capital Q and p. Of course, these are functions of the old ones. But I just limit this possible. So, of course, there will be endless possibilities of finding new transformations. But I limit these to such a case where I can find a new Hamiltonian H prime so that the Hamilton's equations still take the same form. Okay, so it's the form invariance. It's not the actual invariance, but it's the form invariance of the Hamilton's equations. And so not every transformation is canonical, but there are many canonical transformations. And in fact, they are in one-to-one correspondence with some generating functions. So if you have a generating function, there's a corresponding canonical transformation and vice versa. And so generating functions are always, so these are some functions, and they're always functions of one old coordinate and one new one. And so basically, you do sort of transform, you transform from small q to capital Q. We can think about it like that. Okay, so as an example, you take small q and capital Q, and then you use the freedom which you have in the Lagrangian description. So this would be your Lagrangian here, and then you know that you can add to the Lagrangian a total derivative of a function which depends on coordinates. Okay, so this is the freedom I have in the Lagrangian description, but you can write it explicitly, and so now your function f depends on Q, but it also depends on capital Q, and in principle, it depends on T. Okay, so now you can group the terms together, and this is what you get. So I'm just grouping the terms here. But in order this transformation to be canonical, so I need that actually my Lagrangian in new coordinates looks like this, because if it does, then I can go through the derivations of the Hamilton's equations, and then I will find that precisely this will be true. Okay, so this is what I demand, and this is precisely the form invariance of the Hamilton's equations. Okay, so now I can compare term by term, and because I see there is no small q dot here, whatever stands before q dot has to be zero, so that gives me the first relation that small p is df over d small q. So now the next term I see q dot here, and what stands in front of it has to be capital P. So that's why this thing here has to be capital T P, and that's the middle relation here. And finally, if I say that H plus df over dt is H prime, that's my new Hamiltonian, in you know, for which I will have the standard canonical equations. All right, so this is beautiful, and so we will try to exploit this freedom today to formulate the Hamilton-Jacobi theory, and you will see how beautiful it is actually. But before I go there, let me just briefly repeat this statement. And well, I was saying that the time evolution and so you can think about the time evolution. Well, I have Q of t, which is a function of, let's say, the initial data, q1, p1, and t. And then I have p of t. The momentum also evolves according to. So this is what I'm after. So if I specify the initial data, how my positions and momenta look like at time t1, then, of course, what I'm trying to find is how they look later. At later times. But you immediately see that I can actually think about this as if q1 and p1 were my old coordinates, So the small ones here, whereas Q and P would be my new coordinates, so which I previously wrote as capital Q and capital P. Okay, so this is how you view time evolution if you want to describe it as a canonical transformation. So I start from initial data, and I say, well, these are my new old coordinates, Q and P, and then I'm interested in later Q and P, in the time evolution of Q and P. I say these are my new coordinates, which were previously denoted by capital Q and capital P. Okay, so now what I was mentioning, but I have not proved, but anyway, is that if you construct a Hamilton's function, which is basically nothing else than the action evaluated on the true trajectories. So you take the action, you do the variation of principle, you write down the Euler-Lagrange equations. In principle, you can solve these equations, find the solutions in terms of the initial data, in terms of the boundary data, so Q1, P1, but also Q2 and P2. And then you plug it back into your Lagrangian, into your action, integrate over time between T1 and T2. And that's what the Hamilton's function is. And so what I was sort of saying is that if you have the Hamilton's function, which is, of course, a function of these Q1, P1, Q2, P2, but also T1 and T2, then you have this relation here, minus T minus S dt. And this must be equal to dq minus h dt. So now I'm calling T2 and Q. Okay, so I'm also making an identification with this Q2 and P2. Because I can take time T2 to be arbitrary. So anyway, so this is true. So S here is the Hamilton function. The Hamilton function, and so if you take its difference, it's a function of T1, which I call T here, Q1, P1, and then Q2 and P2 and whatever. So if you take the differential, this is what you get. So now you can integrate this over time, okay? And then I integrate this over time, and so what is written here is whatever happened in the initial time, T1, plus a total differential of some function, okay, equals to whatever happens at the later time. Okay, so now I can look at this expression here, and I want to compare it with this expression here. And you see that this is precisely what's happening, right? So I start at time T1, and I have some old coordinates, P1 and Q1, which I called here small p and small q. And then I add a total differential of something. And so this is that. Okay, let's call it, 1. And so this is 1. And this thing is what happens at later time in the new coordinates. So this is this 2, which I wanted. Okay. So I'm comparing this with that, and I'm just looking at the time evolution as a transformation between the initial data Q1, P1, and the final data, Q and P. All right? And so you see that really you can compare this with that. And then from here, you see that really the time evolution, this type of transformation, is a canonical transformation where my generating function is just f equals to minus s. Okay, so in other words, time evolution can be viewed as time evolution can be viewed as canonical transformation . Of course, we are also mixing sort of active and passive point of view. So you can think about time evolution as really I am shifting somewhere, or you can just view it as a change of coordinates. Okay, so that's. Are there any questions to this? So very intuitively, it should, yes?
Yes, so the I don't get the equation on the left hand side of that equation, because so P1 in the equation above, P1 and Q1, those are initial conditions, right?
That's right.
So they're not functions of time, right? And they're being integrated over time then.
They are being integrated basically over T1.
That's T though. I can name time whatever.
It's just a dummy variable, right? So you're just integrating over some dummy variable which you can either be called T1 or T or whatever, right? So that's what you are doing.
Okay.
This proof is confusing. there's a little bit more about it in Landau and Lifshitz. I'm not claiming it's the best proof of this, but the result is correct.
So can it be interpreted as Q1 of t equals Q of t minus something?
Q1 of t is Q of t.
Yeah, just follow the discussion about.
Well, of course, you can expand this, and you can assume that Q is close to Q1 and whatever, and then you can do some infinitesimal transformation if you want. Is that what you are asking, or?
No, just because you were saying that we're mixing this active and passive transformation. Like Q1 can be looked as a time shift of Q.
Mm-hmm. Which would be like an active. I'm really transforming somewhere. I start somewhere, and then I do a time evolution, which is like an active point of view.
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, I'm saying, well, I can just view that as I'm fixing that and then just changing coordinates so that it looks different.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Other questions? So as I'm saying, if you don't like this proof, find your own. But we should end up with this result. Okay. Very good. So now there is another last thing which I want to discuss about these canonical transformations in this section is the Liouville's theorem. And so you probably know Liouville's theorem in statistical physics. It says that if you have the distribution function, that its total derivative with respect to time is equal to zero. So that's precisely this one, which I'm going to discuss. But Liouville was very effective guy, and so he has many theorems in very many different areas of physics. So you will see later an integrability theorem, so where he basically shows what are the conditions for you to integrate the classical systems, but there are many other. So then he has theorems in pure differential geometry and stuff like that. So one of the theorems, so Liouville's theorem. And if you want to search this one on Wikipedia, you would say something like Liouville's theorem in either Hamiltonian mechanics or statistical mechanics. So basically, imagine a situation that, this is your phase space portrait. So typically, if you have a system, then, it describes a point. Well, at given time, the system describes a point in the phase space. And so this point then later evolves to somewhere else at later time. But now, in statistical physics, you know that there is lots of uncertainty in description. And basically, given the macroscopic state, I can have lots of microscopic states, which actually are consistent with my macroscopic one. And so then you actually describe your system more like a distribution of things. We will discuss that next week. So anyway, so imagine that I don't have just one point in that phase space, but that I have the whole volume in the phase space. And let's say the volume has a picture of a cat. Okay, so this is my cat. Here. And let's say this is, and so really the system can be described by a non-trivial volume in the phase space. At time t equal to zero, we have the volume V0. Okay? So now you do a time evolution on this. So you evolve, and so each point here actually evolves according to Hamilton's equations. So each point will follow some trajectory and will end up, after some time, will end up somewhere else. And so what may happen is that your picture of a cat gets truly deformed. Okay, so this is my new cat after time evolution. And so it can be squashed and whatever. Many bad things can happen. But what is the statement of this theorem? So I have, after time evolution, I will have volume of the cat will be V at T. And the statement is that the volume will remain the same. Okay? So statement is the volume of the phase space remains invariant under time evolution, but more generally under any canonical transformation. Under canonical transformations. Or, you know, specifically under time evolution. Okay, so that's the theorem. And then you can show that from this formulation of the theorem, really, it's two lines to show that the density distribution function in your statistical physics remains constant a long time. But it's also immediate to show that actually your system has to follow the Gibbs distribution. So it's like two lines to one another nice beautiful theorem, another two lines to Gibbs distribution and to the basics of statistical physics. So maybe we'll do that next week, but let's just leave it here. It's an interesting theorem. So how do you prove this theorem? And so I will do the simplest possible case of the proof. So I will just choose the system when we have only one dimension, just for the sake of simplicity. And so if you view this time evolution as a canonical transformation, this is really a transformation from small p and q to capital P and q. And that's what describes my time evolution. Okay, so then if I'm interested in the volume at time t, it's simply an integral over the capital P and the capital Q. Okay, so if I want to find the volume of this cat, I just integrate capital P and capital Q. Okay, but now I can use whatever, it's probably Fubini's theorem or something like that of the change of variables. So I can write this as an integral over the old coordinates, dp and q, but then I will have a Jacobian here of the transformation, dp and dq. Okay, so that's how the Fubini's theorem works. Is it Fubini's theorem? Maybe.
What?
the change of variables in multidimensional integral. So you just start with some variables, you change variables, and you pick up the Jacobian in transformation. Probably Fubini's theorem. All right, so now let's look what the Jacobian is. So this Jacobian is basically a determinant of the transformation where you consider the rows are dq over dq and dq over dp. Well, that's the row, and then you will have p here over dq and dp over dp. And it's this determinant here. So if I have system with 1 degree of freedom, it's just 2 by 2 matrix and determinant of that. So that's easy to calculate determinants. That's why I do it here. So determinant is this times that minus this times that. Okay, so it's dq over dq dp over dp minus dq over dp dp over dq. Everybody happy with this? Okay, so now can you tell me what this is? Sorry? It's the Poisson bracket, exactly. So it's just the Poisson bracket of q and p. But now I just write it in terms of coordinates small q and p, right? But then what is that equal to? And that must be equal to 1 because we demand that the transformation is canonical. And of course, the fundamental brackets for canonical transformations, they remain the same, and that's why it has to be weak to 1. So this is where the fact that it's a canonical transformation enters. Okay, so this is equal to 1. But of course, if this is equal to 1, then this is just equal to integral over dp and dq over the old coordinates, so over the old cap. And so that's just v0. Okay, so in case of one dimension, this is really simple and nice to prove that you have this Liouville's theorem. And as I say, this is a very important theorem. So no matter how you squash the cat, its volume still remains the same. Okay? I don't know what happens in real life if you actually drive over a cat. Probably the volume does not. I don't know. That's a morbid thing. Okay. Questions? All right. So if not, let's go to this beautiful Hamilton-Jacobi theory. So pa d, Hamilton-Jacobi theory. All right. So now, this is really an ingenious idea. So what the idea is that we have this, you know, huge freedom in the canonical transformations. Okay, and so we can find new Hamiltonian, and we can find new coordinates. So that you know, so let's try to simplify our life as much as we can. Okay, of course, the biggest simplification for the Hamilton's equations is if I can find new h prime, which is 0. If I can do such a canonical transformation that my new h prime is 0, well, I can immediately solve these equations here. I know that q is a constant and p is a constant, and I'm done. Okay, so I've solved the equations of motion. So that's the ingenious idea of the Hamilton-Jacobi theory. So ingenious idea. Idea is to do a special canonical transformation okay, and so this will be generated again by some function. And do you know how we call this function for the lack of letters? S.
S.
Everything is S, right? Generated by generating function S. Of course, it will turn out it's precisely the Hamilton's equation, Hamilton's function, and it's precisely the action, right? So do a special canonical transformation so that the new h prime is identically equal to 0. Well, if that is true, h prime is equal to 0. Really, this thing is 0, so qj must be a constant. So then, qj. Is equal to alpha j, which is a constant. So we have some constants alpha. And similarly here, pj is a constant. And we want to kill the minus sign. So people typically put pj equals to beta j, which is a constant, but now is a minus sign. People don't like that minus sign here. So that's why they put minus sign. Okay, so we have solved the Hamilton's equations. Well, that's great. So we just know that, you know, there is, if this can be done, we know that we have solved the Hamilton's equations in some new coordinates. But of course, at this point, we don't know what these coordinates are, right? We don't know how they are related. to the old coordinate, so we don't, well, we solve the problem, but we don't know anything, right? So how, you know, how do you do this? So it's to really assume that I can find this generating function S and then use these conditions for the generating function S. Okay, so now let's, for example, look at this relation here. So first, the middle relation. Okay, so then the middle relation. Middle relation gives us that Pj, which is, however, a constant, it's minus beta j, is equal to ds over the qj, but qj is alpha j. Okay, so why can I differentiate with respect to alpha and with respect to alpha? So s was a function of q and q, but capital Q is now alpha. So it really depends. My solution depends on alpha. So this is a function of q and alpha and t. Okay, so that's the middle relation. But look at this beauty. So on the left side, I have a constant beta. On the right side, I have something which is a function of small q, alpha, and t. And I differentiate with respect to alpha, so this will still be a function of q, alpha, and t. Okay, so in other words, this is an implicit relation for how my small q looks in terms of alpha and beta constants. Okay, so this is an implicit equation for how q looks in terms of alpha, beta, and t. Okay, but of course alpha, beta are just constants of integration, not just constants. So what if you can find this, if you can invert the relation and find q as a function of alpha, beta, then you solved your problem, right? You have a solution for your trajectory in terms of two constants. Well, it has to be, it's a second order differential equation and time. Okay, so this is the solution I want. Solution we want. Okay. Well, very good. So we have used 3 out of 5 equations. We have used the Hamilton's equations here. They just give us that Q and P are constants. And we have used this equation here to actually find the solution. But of course, we have the solution only when we actually know what S is, right? So then we can actually differentiate the right-hand side with respect to alpha. And then we can actually really write it down. So the last two equations better tell us what S is, how to find S. Okay. So then the last question is how to find S. Okay, if you can find S, then we have the solution here. And if you look at this equation here, that's precisely how you do it. So you know that H prime is 0. So your equation is actually 0 equals to the old H plus ds over dt. So we have that 0 is equal to the old one plus ds over dt. And the first relation tells us that ds over the small q is the small p. ds over dq is small p. Okay, so now we have to combine these two equations together. So Hamiltonian is a function of q and p. Okay, so what this actually tells you is that you take the Hamiltonian, and wherever you see p, you plug ds over dq. Okay, so your equation is that we have ds over dt plus Hamiltonian, which depends on q, and then it would depend on p, but wherever you see p, you just plug ds over dq over t. And this is how you combine the two equations together. And that's it. This is the famous Hamilton-Jacobi equation. It's the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. And basically, solving a mechanical problem means, well, in order to solve the mechanical problem, I have to find the solution of this Hamilton-Jacobi equation. So I have to find this function s. And if I can find this function s as a function of q and some integration constant and t, so if I can solve that, then this prescription here gives my solution to the problem. So now this is so amazing, right? So we started with the Euler-Lagrange equations, which are, if you have n degrees of freedom, you have n of those equations, and they are second order ordinary differential equations. Okay, then we said, okay, we don't want second order, we want first order. And so we went to the Hamilton's equations and to the Hamiltonian description. And so we had now 2n first order differential equations. But now I'm telling you, actually, all of that is equivalent to simple one equation here, the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. This is just one PDE for s q of t. And if you can solve this one partial differential equation, then you solve the mechanical problem. Okay, isn't this amazing? All right, so any questions to this? Now we used all the equations, it must be all fine. Who has seen this? Some of you. For some of you, it's new, that's great. So really, you know, the beauty of this is that we transform everything to just one equation here. Of course, the problem is that it's a partial differential equation, and the partial differential equations are quite nasty. But at least you have just one equation here. Okay, so now what you want to do is, so if you studied partial differential equations, you typically know that, well, you know that there are two types of solutions. One of the solution is called like a general solution, a general integral, and typically that will be that it's some arbitrary function of something. So for example, if you take wave equation, right? So I have two derivatives of time minus two derivatives in x, then you know that the solution of the wave equation is an arbitrary function of x minus vt, where v is the propagation speed of your waves. So if you take any function x of x minus vt, it will be a solution. Okay, so that's general integral for partial differential equations. So we are not interested in those, because we want to rather find s as a function of some integrals of motion, of some constants alpha. Okay, so when you are solving this, solving Hamilton-Jacobi, we are interested in a different type of solution, and this is called a complete integral. We are interested in complete integral which is a solution that depends on your integration constants. So complete integral is a solution which depends on n integration constants. Rather than the general integral, which would tell me, well, the solution is an arbitrary function of some weird combination of variables. Okay, and so how you find these complete integrals is typically by separation of variables. Okay, so the trick is to use the method of separation of variables And so what you can show, but I will not show it, but I'll just tell you the result, is that, for example, h is not a function of time. If that happens, then you can show that you can always find the full function sqft as a function which is independent of t, and then minus an integration constant e and times t. Okay, so if h does not depend on time, then the statement is this type of separation of variables actually solves. You can find a solution of your Hamilton-Jacobi equation in the separation of variables method. Okay, and where this is a constant. Anybody knows what is the interpretation of this constant?
Energy.
It will be the energy. So you know that if Hamilton doesn't depend on time, then the energy is conserved. So there will be an integral of motion, and it's precisely this E here. Okay. So similarly, if you have a cyclic variable, so if the Hamiltonian doesn't depend on one variable, for example, phi is absent, then S of Q and T can be written as QC plus something where, well, S C. So Q1 is there, Q2 is there, but QC is missing Qn of T. Okay? So again, if your Hamiltonian doesn't depend on, let's say, phi, then there will be a corresponding constant alpha C. Times this phi, and then plus some other function which does not depend on phi. Okay, so this hat means that the phi will be missing, the QC will be missing. Okay, so now would anybody know what is the meaning of alpha C constant? Sorry?
The conjugated momentum.
It would be the conjugated momentum. So if QC were phi, the angle, then this would be actually the angular momentum around phi. Okay, so more generally. So this is guaranteed to work. So you can prove that if this is the case, then this will definitely work. Okay, so more generally, however, we can try so-called additive separation ansatz, whether it's justified or not. Okay, so we can always try to say that, well, my S of Q and T, QI and T, is simply a sum of functions, each of which depends only on one variable. So it will be S1, which depends only on Q1, plus S2, which depends on Q2, and so on, as Sn on Qn. Okay? And then I can have maybe minus Et or whatever if my Hamiltonian doesn't depend on time, or you could try some function of time here. Okay, so you can always try this. And of course, solving PDEs is an art. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, right? And so if the magic works, and you use this separation ansatz, and plug it to the equation, and you can show that the equation can be solved, then you won the lottery, and then you actually integrated the system. Okay, if it doesn't work, it doesn't mean that you cannot integrate the system. It may mean that you have wrong coordinates. So unfortunately, the separation of variables and stuff like that, it depends on which coordinates I'm using. So in one coordinates, it may separate. In the other coordinates, it may not separate. So you can easily spend lifetime trying to find the right coordinates for which the system separates, or actually maybe the system does not separate, and then you are screwed up. Okay, so this is heavy theory, and you know it seems quite formidable and it seems super strange. So let me just convince you on a simple example that this actually works. Okay, so let's consider an example. We have maybe not enough. Well, I'll try. I'll start here, and if you don't have enough space, I will continue on some different blackboard. And that will be a free fall in homogeneous gravitational field. So you will have an opportunity to study a much more complicated example in your tutorial, but because I'm doing things on the blackboard, I decided to do a simple example. So, all right. So the first step which you have to do is you have to write down your Hamilton-Jacobi equation for the system. Okay? So that means first I need to find the Hamiltonian. Can anybody tell me what the Hamiltonian for a free fall is in a homogeneous field in one dimension?
P squared divided by 2m.
Perfect. So that's a good start. So we have p squared over 2m. Okay, and then let's say my height is parameterized by coordinate x. So this is the kinetic energy, and Hamiltonian is kinetic energy plus potential energy. What is the potential energy?
Mga.
Perfect. So it's plus the potential. But the potential actually, well, is a minus sign, but yeah, it was good. mgx. Okay? So x will describe the height of my fall, and this is the corresponding potential. So that's the Hamiltonian. Okay, perfect. So we have the Hamiltonian. So now we want to write down the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. And the prescription is, you know, take your Hamiltonian, and wherever you see momentum, write ds over dx. Yes?
It should be a plus on the potential. When you go up a hill, you gain potential energy, so you can then fall, right?
It's a conserved energy.
X is going up, right?
Okay. Let's see. So if I fall down, I have zero. Well, it depends on how x goes, right? Well, I have a minus here in my notes. Let's stick to minus. And then you orient your x so that it works. Okay. Very good. So now we are looking for, so the Hamilton-Jacobi will be an equation for s as a function of x and t, so as a function of coordinate and the time. And I just get it by wherever I see p, I just write ds over dx. So then I will have p squared over 2m, so it's 1 over 2m. And instead of p, I just write ds over dx squared. That's p squared over 2m. And then plus the potential, which has x, so that's fine, it's minus mgx, and then plus ds over dt. Okay, so that's my Hamilton-Jacobi equation. Easy peasy to find it, right? Very good. So now I notice immediately that my Hamiltonian does not depend on time. Okay, so the Hamiltonian is just p squared over 2m plus v. There's no time dependence. Okay, so since h is not a function of time, then I can look for s in the separated form here. So it will be s0 as a function of x only minus et. Okay, so now I just take this ansatz here and plug it into the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. So then I have 1 over 2m Of course, now ET does not depend on x, so it'll be just S0, so it'll be ds0 over dx, but S0 depends only on x, so it's no longer a partial derivative, but it's a total derivative, because S0 depends only on x. So it's ds over ds0 over dx square, and then plus v. And then if I do ds over dt partial derivative, I pick up a minus e. And that's my thing. So of course now, this thing here is just an ordinary differential equation. It's just an equation for S0, which is a function of x. So actually, I can integrate this. So from here, you find that S0 is an integral over 2m e minus v dt dx. Okay, so I'm just finding the integral of this equation. All right, maybe let me continue here. So then what was the, so now I have the full S, right? I know that full S is this S0, which actually you can do the integral explicitly if you want, but this is my S0, and then my full S is that S0 minus ET. So I really know what my S is, okay? So what that means is that now I have the full S. So my full S is S0 minus ET. And then the procedure was, in this middle table, blackboard, is that so how did we, how did we find the solution? We said, well, if we have the S here, and that S depends on some integration constant alpha, just differentiate with respect to constant alpha, set it equal to another constant beta minus, and that gives you the solution. So now our S0 depends on E. Well, our S depends on E, so the next step will be, well, let's do ds over dE, okay, and set it equal to a new constant. Let's call it beta. Did I put minus beta?
Yeah. Wasn't there a square, the ds not dx?
Yeah. Thank you. Sorry. Thank you. Let me square root, like that. Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Sorry for that. All right, so this is that. So just differentiate your solution with respect to your constant of integration, set it equal to another constant, should be minus beta, but anyway. So what is this? So if I differentiate S with respect to E, I just get a minus T. Minus T. But also, your solution S0 depends on E, okay? So now my S0 is an integral over the X and depends on E. So I want to differentiate, partial differentiate with respect to E, I can pull it through the integral. If I differentiate with respect to E, instead of square root, I get 1 over square root. Okay, so it's plus integral over the X, 1 over square root, TM, what is it, E minus V, E minus V. And then if I differentiate that with respect to E, I also get 2M here. Okay, so now you can do the integration, but of course v depends only linearly on x, so you can actually do the integral explicitly. And so what you should find is that this is equal to 1 over mg 2m e minus v. It's easy to check that this is a solution minus t. Okay, so this is how you get. And then this is equal to beta, because I'm differentiating with respect to E, setting that equal to a constant. All right, so now the statement was, well, this is actually an implicit solution of how Q depends on alpha, beta, and T. So this better be an implicit solution how X depends on my E and beta. Okay, but V is minus mgx. So now we can really take this relation here and invert it. Okay, so I just put t here, I square it, and then I evaluate x. And if you do that from here by inversion, one line, which I will not try to repeat here because I would fail, is x equals to g half t plus beta square minus e over mg. Okay, so this is what you find when you invert that. E mg. So see that this, you know, crazy procedure actually really gave you that x depends quadratically on time. So now you see the interpretation of the of this integration constant beta is just a choice of initial time. But of course, E is an energy, right? And so there will be the conserved energy. And so even at time equal to zero, when this guy vanishes, this gives you, you know, the position of x depending on the energy. Okay, so this crazy procedure indeed works. And you know, the steps are really simple. So you just formulate the Hamilton-Jacobi equation starting from the Hamiltonian and plugging everywhere ds over dq, where you see p. Then you try to solve it by separation of variables. If you succeed, as in this case, well, it was sort of guaranteed because there was time independent, so we had integration constant e. So it was guaranteed that x and t will separate from each other. But anyway, so then you find the full s, which is this s0 minus et. That depends on some integration constant, on the separation constant, if you want. So e is the separation constant. And then you differentiate that with respect to the separation constant, set it equal to another constant, and that gives you the solution.
There's no x in this equation.
X is hiding here, b. So b is minus mgx. Sorry, I was. So really, what you have to do is that you put here this thing, then you multiply by mg, then you square it, and then you have 2m e minus v. So it's you have e plus mgx here, and then you have to evaluate dx, right? Yeah, sorry, I just skipped that line. Isn't that beautiful? All right. So that's the Hamilton-Jacobi theory. And basically, all integrable systems, not all of them, but many of them, were discovered by separation of variables in the Hamilton-Jacobi. So from theoretical point of view, the Hamilton-Jacobi equation is very, very fundamental. And it really, you know, led to lots of discoveries. But I think the very fact that you can formulate, you know, the mechanic system is one PDE is beautiful on its own. So the Hamilton-Jacobi theory also provides like super nice transition from quantum mechanics through the geometric optics approximation or the WKB approximation. So let me just briefly comment on that. So connection. Quantum mechanics. And so you know that if you have the Schrödinger equation, it's basically a time evolution first order time evolution equation for your wave function. And so for a mechanics problem, your Hamiltonian h hat is just p square hat over 2m plus the potential. So it's just the normal Hamiltonian, but now you put everywhere hats so that it looks nicer. And then let me do it in the x representation so that, you know, x is just the representation of the operator x is just multiplying by x, but the momentum operator is just minus I h derivative. So p really becomes an operator. Okay, so that's our quantum mechanics. And now we want to take some kind of classical limit. And so this is typically achieved in setting h bar goes to 0 and see what remains out of your thing. Okay, so now we use the geometric optics approximation or WKB approximation.
And are you choosing recordings such that small? Is this just a
sorry, what is number?
H bar
is number. Yeah, I'll show you what I'm doing. So the geometric approximation, this one here, basically states, well, I can choose my full psi as something which does not depend on anything times the exponential where you have a phase which depends on x and t. But this exponential is weighted by 1 over h bar. Okay, so that's the geometric optics approximation. So that's the ansatz here. And then you assume this is constant, and this goes like 1 over h bar. Okay. So let's see what happens when we plug in this approximation. So we have IH. So then IH d psi over dt. Okay. So when you differentiate with respect to time, you just bring this exponent down, and will be ds over dt. So what it is equal to is minus ds over dt, because you have I squared there, and then the original psi. And this better be equal to the Hamiltonian on psi. So now the Hamiltonian is p squared over 2m. So p squared is Nabla square, and then there's a minus and an h bar square. So this is minus h bar square over 2m Nabla square plus v acting on psi. That's my h psi. But now I have this psi of this form here. So this thing actually, well, and you have two derivatives. So there will be a term where you have two derivatives acting on s, and there will be a term where you have one derivative acting on s but square. Okay? So then this will be just Nabla s square over 2m. That's one term. And then minus ih 2m Nabla square on s plus v acting on psi. Okay? You just do two derivatives on the exponential, and either you have term which is one derivative, but another term like that, it's the first term, or you have actually two derivatives of the S term here. Okay, very good. So now you take the limit h bar goes to 0. So now h bar goes to 0. And if you look at the equation, so we have minus ds, so minus ds over dt acting on psi is, of course, this term does not depend on h bar, so that this term survives. But this one actually vanishes. H bar goes to 0. So the middle term is gone. So it's equal to Nabla s square over 2m plus v acting on psi. But of course, psi is redundant here. Psi is non-trivial. It's an exponential. So I can divide by psi, because there's no operation acting on psi. So you have that. And if you stare at this, it's nothing else than our Hamilton-Jacobi equation. Right? So this is the Hamilton-Jacobi equation.
Sorry, how do you get the curly line, the first line, the partial s part of...
This one here?
Yeah, the next equation, yeah.
This one here?
Yeah, yeah.
No, I just take this ansatz here.
The next
one is just, it's just h hat acting on psi. But I'm using that p hat is minus ih Nabla, right? So I'm just writing p square. So p square will be I square, h bar square, and Nabla square, which is this thing here, and plus v. It's just h.
Do we use the
Hamiltonian Jacobi equation here. So how?
No. I'm just using this form of P.
But the left-hand side is partialized partial T. The partialized partial T phi equation.
The only partial derivative with respect to time is on the left side, which is this thing here. Then I am evaluating the right side, which is only spatial derivatives, right? So nabla is only spatial derivative here. It's just this thing. I'm just writing down explicitly in the X representation how H looks like, and it's given by this. And then I'm just applying to this my special choice of psi. Okay, so you see that actually, you recover the Hamilton-Jacobi equation in the limit h bar goes to zero. And of course, this is precisely related to the fact that in quantum mechanics, if you fix endpoints, you have all possible trajectories here. And some are more likely or less likely, but in fact, all of them happen. But in the limit h bar goes to zero, only the one for which the action is stationary actually contributes. That's the classical trajectory, which is the most likely one, if you want. And that's given by your Hamilton-Jacobi equation. So this is, I think, the most beautiful transition to classical mechanics, if you want. All right, are there any questions? Yes?
I don't understand how the action being stationary is implied by this.
Oh, you can think about it like Hamilton-Jacobi theory, Hamilton's equations, or Euler-Lagrange equations. In principle, they are just, different sides of the same coin. So they describe the same physics, and they are encoded in this least action principle. So once you are, you get all these equations by demanding that the action is stationary, that you have the classical trajectory.
But it's like if we didn't derive Schrodinger equation using that.
Exactly. No. So this is that's absolutely correct. So this is some more fundamental theory which does not follow from anything, right? So you postulate the fundamental theory, right? That's your theory of quantum mechanics, and then this theory better actually, in the classical limit, it better reduces to something you already know in classical physics, and that's how it is done here. All right. More questions? So as I said, so this Hamilton-Jacobi theory is super interesting, super nice, and super useful when actually, trying to approach classical mechanics from a theoretical point of view. And you will have an opportunity in your tutorial to study a more complicated case than just a motion in a homogeneous field. In fact, you will study the Kepler problem using the Hamilton-Jacobi theory. And you will see that it's pain, but it's possible. All right, so let me start a new section, section E, which let me call it symmetries. And first thing I would actually like to discuss is the Hamiltonian vector field or vector fields. Okay, and so basically what I will try to do now is to provide some geometrical picture to your Hamiltonian mechanics. Like, it will be at the intuitive level, but it's really nice to think about, integrals of motion and stuff like that in terms of this geometrical meaning. And so we start with a very simple observation, is that any phase space function, so any function of x and p, actually defines some nice geometrical flows in your phase space, okay? So given any phase space function, and so I will now limit myself to function of q and p, but there is no time explicit time dependent. So everything I am doing now I just kill the time dependence just to make things easier. In fact, if you want to include time dependence, you have to go to the contact geometry, you have to enlarge your phase space and stuff like that. So it's quite complicated to actually include explicit time dependence. So let's just assume it's not so. Okay, so now I have this function. So I specify this function, let's say q squared plus p squared. Okay, so then to this function, you can immediately write down an operator. Okay, and so this operator is simply given by your Poisson bracket, where you leave the first slot in the Poisson bracket empty. Okay, so let's just take our definition of the canonical bracket, and it's d over dq of the first one times d over dp of the second one. So let me just write the second one first. So it's dg over dp, and then there is d, but we have an empty slot here, over dq, right? And then it's minus the other way around, so it's minus dg over dq and d over dp. And there's something left here. Of course, this is nothing else than a differential operator, right? So if I take any other function f, you know, this is some number here, but then this differential operator will act on my function f. So I will differentiate f with respect to q. This is some number, but then this will differentiate f with respect to p. Okay, so this is a differential operator. But if you have taken any courses on differential geometry, this is how the vectors are defined. Okay, so any differential operator, you should be thinking about any differential operator as a vector. Well, it is a vector, sort of, right? So if you think about this is some number, so this is a component, and this is the direction which we want to differentiate with respect to, or, you know, the basis of a vector. So this is again a component, and this is the direction. So what this thing is actually telling me, I can think about this as a vector, x, g, as a vector. And you know, if I have p and q, well, what this thing is telling me, you know, the component is telling me how much you move, how much you differentiate, but this one is telling me let's differentiate in the q direction. So I'll have a q direction, d over dq, and I'm differentiating the function in this direction, or I have d over dp, and then I'm differentiating the function with respect to that direction. Well, these are actually vectors. They are directional vectors in my phase space. And the components, they tell me, well, in this direction, go that much further, and in that direction, go that much further. So the components tell us, you know, how far you go in that direction. And this tells me I'm differentiating in that direction, or I'm differentiating in that direction. Well, that's precisely what vectors do, right? So the components of the vector tell me, well, go much that far in the x direction, go much that far in the y direction, go much that far in the z direction, and so on. So it's obvious that the differential operators actually are vectors. Okay? And so you should be thinking about vectors as really one-to-one correspondence between the vectors and the differential operators. Okay? And then I'll finally write one more equality, which is even more crazy one. And I'll just define this to be d over d dg. It's a total derivative with respect to some time generated by my function g. Okay, picture. So the picture is I am in my phase space. So this is my p and this is my Q. So now at every point of that phase space, you sort of have this vector xg. Okay, so I'll have, okay, let me first draw the line. And then I'll have the vector xg here, vector xg here. But I'll have also another line here, so that will be a vector xg here, and so on. So you have a vector field which lives in your phase space. Well, not entirely. I will show it doesn't live in that space, but almost. And then there is a fundamental theorem of differential geometry, is that if you have the vector field, if it's nice and smooth, it generates the corresponding curves. And the curves are such that at every point the vector field is tangent to that curve. Okay, so there will be one curve generated by this vector field, so that the vector is always tangent to that curve. And then of course I have that everywhere in the phase space, so I will have another curve, and the vector field which lives everywhere will also have the tangent space here. Okay, so now we have the corresponding curves. Let's call them gamma of G. Okay, so we have curves in the phase space which are generated by this xg. And xg is basically this differential operator. Okay, so now you can take any curve you want here. So let me take this one here. And let's try to parameterize that curve. And you should be thinking about this curve very in physical terms, like I have a motion of a particle or something like that. So I start my motion at some tg equal to 0. And then I evolve along this curve. And so my particle will be here when tg equals to 1, and then will be here when tg equals to 2, and so on. So actually, I parameterize the motion of the particle by the associated time. Okay? So very good. So these curves, curves parameterized. By time tg. Okay? And so once you understand this geometrical picture, so any phase space function, I can take this Poisson bracket, leave one slot empty. I can always do that. That gives me the differential operator. But the differential operator you should be thinking about as a vector. Okay? And so then that vector basically tells me, as I move along that vector, my time evolves. So it corresponds to some time evolution along this corresponding curve. Okay. So now some terminology. So tg is the time flow. Well, time flow generated by g. By my phase space function g. Xg is the Hamiltonian vector flow, again generated by g, of g. Okay, and so the construction is such that my curves and then gamma g are the integral curves of xg. So these are the curves such that the vector x is always tangent to them. Okay? Isn't this beautiful? So any phase space function generates these vector fields and these curves gamma, and then has associated with it this corresponding time evolution. Just think about physics. Just put a particle there, and then let it evolve along that curve, and that's your time. All right. But now you see from here that the Hamiltonian is not any special. Hamiltonian is simply one such phase space function. Right? Let's say for the harmonic, for whatever we have here was p squared over 2m, plus x. Okay, so that was one special. So Hamiltonian. Hamiltonian is not special. So it's just that you call the corresponding G to be H, right? I just give it a different letter. But other than that, it's just the same thing. There is one very important distinction, is that, of course, you have now, you would write everywhere H, right? So you have XH, so that's fine. So that would be the Hamiltonian vector field generated by my Hamiltonian H. You would have gamma H, that's fine, as the integral curve generated by Hamiltonian H. But people never write TH, they write T. Except, that's the fundamental difference, except TH, simply people write T. And they say, this is my time evolution. Right? So the time flow generated by the Hamiltonian is simply T. That's the only difference. All right. So what this means is that if I actually return back my slot, so now I fill the slot, which I left empty. So specifically, we get that if we fill this, f and g, okay, so now I'm filling that slot. What it means is that my vector field now acts on this function f. I just, wherever I had an empty slot, I just put f there. Okay, so that gives me some new function. But looking at this is just df over dtg. In other words, if I have my integral curve, gamma g, so what is this doing is that it takes the function f at some time, tg equal to 0, and you know it is interested in how much f changes as I drag it along my curve. So how, so this will be at f at tg equal to 1 or whatever. So it's really a time evolution of f. So this is a time evolution of f along gamma g. Okay, so you should be thinking about the Poisson brackets as really time evolving along the corresponding vector field, along the corresponding curve of that given function. So now I fill the spot which I left empty before. I just put it there. Any questions to this? Isn't this beautiful? It's just, you know, think about Hamiltonian mechanics like in these geometrical terms, and it's so nice. All right. So we have this description here. So now think about what you would call a symmetry. Okay? So let's say, you know, there is some special direction in the phase space, which leaves my Hamiltonian invariant or my function invariant. So if I move along that direction, along that curve, the value of the Hamiltonian or the function does not change. That's what you would call a symmetry. Okay? So symmetry of phase space function. Space function f is you would say that if this is true, f and g equals to zero means that f does not change along flow of g. Sorry, I haven't. So you would say that the flow of g, is a symmetry of phase space function f. If that is true, that this is much better. Now it's a full sentence, which actually makes sense. Okay, so flow of g is a symmetry of phase space function f if fg equals to zero. But what it intuitively means is that df over dg equals to zero. So f does not change as I drag it along this corresponding curve gamma g. So what it means is that if I have some value of f here, the same value will be here, the same value will be here, and so on. So this is a symmetry of f, right? So this special direction in the phase space where f does not change. Of course, if I move in this direction, for example, and I take one value of f here, another value of f there, it probably will change, right? So this is not a symmetry of f. But there may be some special direction where actually f does not change. Okay, so that means, you know, if I call this f1 and then this f2, then f1 will be the same as f2 everywhere. All right, so this is easy peasy. So now the most beautiful formulation of Noether's theorem is this one. So we had the general version, which said, well, for every global continuous symmetry, there is an integral of motion. That was the most general and the most fundamental one. Then we saw the explicit one, where I showed you specific transformation, and then we found the corresponding integral of motion. Then you saw version 3 in your tutorial, which was the sneaky version, which didn't make any sense, but anyway gave you the integrals of motion. So now the most beautiful is the Noether theorem, version 4, which I would say a geometric version. Geometric Hamiltonian version. So let there be a symmetry of Hamiltonian H, and let this symmetry be generated by some phase space function. Let's call it EI, generated by phase space function I. Okay, so then the statement is, then I is an integral of motion. Okay, so if we have a symmetry, we have the corresponding integral of motion. Proof of this is super simple. So we know that we have a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. What it means by that definition is that HI equals to zero so that the value of the Hamiltonian doesn't change as I drag it along the flow generated by my function I. Okay, so this is the symmetry. So we assume that we have that. So then the question is, you know, is I an integral of motion? But of course, we know that the bracket is anti-symmetric. Okay, so I can swap these two and pick up a minus sign, but it's equal to zero, so it's still zero. So from here, by anti-symmetry, I have this, that IH equals to zero. By anti-symmetry, symmetry of the Poisson bracket. But what is this? That's the time evolution of I with respect to TH, but I don't write TH, I just write T. So I does not change along the time evolution. That means it's an integral function. So basically the content of the Noether's theorem is because HI is equal to zero, IH is also zero. Okay? But if you think about this, it's quite non-trivial. Because if you plot a phase space diagram here, well, let's say I have the flow generated by my function I, okay? And this flow is a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. So what it means is that if I take h here and h there, the value of the Hamiltonian will be preserved. Okay, so along this curve, as I drag it, the value of the Hamiltonian is preserved. Okay, but then what it means is that if I have another flow generated by the Hamiltonian, the true time flow, which is this one here, so this will be gamma h, so this is really, you know, the time evolution of things, then the statement is that as you drag things along this flow, the value of I does not change. So as I move in this direction in the phase space, I is conserved. Okay? And this is true because the Poisson bracket actually is zero. So that's the geometrical meaning of the Noether's theorem. Questions? Think about it. We'll start from here in about 15 minutes. So thank you.